Have you ever seen those wildlife documentaries? You know, the ones where they have a large herd of zebras in the long grass somewhere, and they're all munching away quite happily, and then suddenly a lion springs out amongst them, and their eyes open wide, and their muscles bunch up, and then they're off, running away. What makes them able to do that? It's a fight or flight response. Animals have this thing where, under a stressful situation, maybe it's a cough response, under a stressful situation, the animal's hormones get all released. It diverts all their blood to their heart, and they get ready to run or fight. So the zebras take off, but something like a rat, if it's cornered, will fight. And people are like that as well. The adrenaline rushes into your heart when you're in a scary situation and you either run or you fight. And we've learned to control this because it's not always good to run. You might run across a road or get hit by a car or something like that, so we've learned to control it. And to do different things. Nowadays we're a bit more refined. Our running might involve switching on the TV and ignoring everybody. Or our fighting might be arguing. But it's still there, this fight or flight response. And today we'll see how the disciples and Jesus respond differently in stressful situations. Now today's passage is carrying on from last week. I don't know whether you remember last week. Jesus was in the Garden of Gethsemane, in deep anguish and stress. And today it leads up to his arrest and his trial by the religious leaders. Jesus had a choice to make last week in the garden: to do the Father's will or not. To drink the cup of God's wrath and so save us from God's judgment against our sin and so become our Saviour. Or to turn away from God's will. Jesus chose not to flee from what was ahead of him, but rather to do the Father's will. We saw that Jesus chose to pray and to model what true discipleship looked like, in contrast to the disciples who fell asleep. He was faithful while they were faithless. He was true while they were false. And the theme continues today. The passage last week ended with Jesus knowing that he was about to be betrayed. Have a look at verse 41. Returning the third time, he said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Enough, the hour has come. Look, the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us go. Here comes my betrayer." You see, the disciples had fallen asleep while Jesus had spent his time praying. And Jesus knows what this will mean. Sleep is often used in the Bible as a symbol of not being ready. It is also just the reality of being asleep. You're not ready for what comes next. And we're about to find out how unready the disciples are compared to Jesus, who has spent his time praying while they have slept. And then onto the scene comes Judas, leading a rabble of people deputized by the Sanhedrin to arrest him in what they hope is the quiet of the night. They're too scared to do it during the day when people might see. I quite like Western stories, and this reminds me of a spaghetti Western where the town council, who think they're a little bit above arresting anyone, or maybe they're too scared to, decide that a certain someone has to be thrown out of town. And so they collect all the rough heads from around town, they pin badges on them and send them out to do their own dirty work. Well, this is a bit what's happening here. The religious leaders have decided that Jesus needs to be arrested. They're too scared to do it themselves, And so they collect this group of people together and send them out to do the job they should have done themselves. And it's quite clear that this group of people has the authority of the religious leaders. Mark makes that point in verse 43. He says that they've been sent from the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders. And this is backed up later by Jesus in verse 49, where he says, "Every day I was with you, teaching in the temple courts, and you did not arrest me." The temple was their domain. That was where they had authority, and they should have felt comfortable. And yet clearly they didn't, otherwise they would have arrested Jesus there. And Judas has clearly thought this whole enterprise through, as he has a prearranged signal with the leaders of the mob who have come to take Jesus away. He says, "Now the betrayer had arranged a signal with them. The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him and lead him away under guard." He obviously doesn't want anything to go wrong, like Jesus getting away, which would somehow lead to repercussions for him. He wants Jesus to be closely guarded and taken away. Judas is one of Jesus' disciples, and therefore he knew where Jesus would be, where he would be spending the night, and how to find him. And therefore he's essential to the success of this mission, so that they could capture Jesus with as little fuss as possible. Now, I don't know about you, but Jesus' greeting of Jesus seems a little bit over the top. I couldn't think of anywhere else in the Gospels where the disciples greet Jesus with a kiss. The only kissing of Jesus that I can remember was when that woman wept over Jesus' feet, dried them with her hair, and poured perfume over them. An extravagant show of love, showing her total devotion to Jesus. Maybe that's the point here. Judas's actions should have been an extravagant show of devotion and love for his teacher, and yet all the time he was planning to betray him. The crowd arrests Jesus and a scuffle breaks out, resulting in an ear getting cut off. You can just imagine it, can't you? All these guys turning up, probably being told that they have a dangerous job to do. They're all nervous and full of the chance of showing how brave they are. Suddenly there's a bit of pushing and shoving, and then a sword comes out and someone's ear gets chopped off. Maybe someone's fight response took over rather than their flight response. Mark says it's one of those standing near, a phrase that's ambiguous. It doesn't say whether it's one of the disciples, one of those on Jesus' side, or is it just someone from the riffraff who got a bit too enthusiastic and hit the wrong person? But Jesus steps in and puts an end to the violence. It's completely unnecessary. To them it might have seemed like a wise precaution, coming to arrest Jesus with clubs and swords. But to us they just look foolish, don't they? Jesus is a non-violent teacher with no weapons, nothing to hide. He's taught daily in the temple under their noses, hardly the activity of someone bent on starting a revolution. And he condemns their violent ways. He says, "Am I leading a rebellion?" Jesus said, "that you have come with swords and clubs to capture me. Every day I was with you, teaching in the temple courts, and you did not arrest me. But the scriptures must be fulfilled." Ironically, Jesus had a go at the temple for being a robber's den instead of a house of prayer for all nations. And now the temple leaders hire strong-arm men to arrest him in the middle of his prayers like a robber. At this point, the flight instincts of the disciples kick in and they're off. They made grand statements about sticking around with Jesus no matter what. They said they would die with him. Look back at verse 31 of chapter 14. Back in the upper room, Peter said, "Even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you." and all the others said the same. That didn't stop them running away. James and John had claimed that they could drink his cup in chapter 10, and yet when the crunch came, they turned and fled. And whoever the young man is that Mark mentions in verse 51 and 52, he flees with nothing on, completely naked and ashamed. Now there's no knowing who this young man is. Some people think that it's a young Mark who's inserted himself into the story. Are there any Alfred Hitchcock fans out there? Who likes Alfred Hitchcock? So, apparently Alfred Hitchcock inserts himself into his films. So if you watch an Alfred Hitchcock film, you'll see a little piece, a little segment, a scene with Alfred Hitchcock in it. And so some people say this is Mark's Alfred Hitchcock moment, that this is Mark inserting himself into the passage. Now, there's no proof of that. It'd be wonderful if Mark was the young man that fled the garden, and then he was discipled by Peter, and he wrote this gospel. That'd be wonderful, but there's no proof of that. What it does show is that the arresting party had stripped away the disciples' last little bit of resolve to follow Jesus. Their mad dash to safety exposes the bareness and nakedness of their empty promises. There's a passage in Leviticus 26 which is appropriate. As for those of you who are left, I will make their hearts so fearful in the lands of their enemies that the sound of a wind-blown leaf will put them to flight. They will stumble over one another as though fleeing from the sword, even though no one is pursuing them. So you will not be able to stand before your enemies. That pretty well sums up the disciples, doesn't it? No one was pursuing them, and yet they took off. And the disciples' panicky flight contrasts sharply with the quiet dignity of Jesus, who has kept watch and is ready. Jesus will now become increasingly alone and must face the horror of his death without any human support. The craven fear of this young man who is seized, stripped, and escapes into the darkness compares badly with Jesus. His courage, when he is seized, stripped, and does not escape, but is crucified. Jesus is faithful, and they are faithless. Well, what are the scriptures that Jesus refers to as being fulfilled in verse 49? Is it the passage in Zechariah that we read out, that Jesus quoted in the garden, about the shepherd being struck and the sheep scattering? Yes, that has been fulfilled. Or is it the fulfillment of Isaiah 53 and the suffering servant passages, where he is numbered with the transgressors and has been arrested? That too has been fulfilled. Or maybe we are to think of another garden seen in the Bible, where a young man hid naked and ashamed. A garden where there had been communion with God. Maybe Mark is hinting that the scriptures that have been fulfilled are all of those that start in that first garden at the beginning of the Bible and end here in this garden. In that first garden where fear, faithlessness, and rejection of God all took place, where man and woman rejected the word of God. All the scriptures between that first garden and this one have been fulfilled in Jesus. In this garden, in contrast, Jesus remained faithful, true to God's word, and said, "Not what I will, but what you will." He had nothing to be ashamed of. Well, Peter, having deserted Jesus along with the others, seems to have decided that it would be best to follow along in the darkness, to sneak back into the high priest's house, to settle down and to watch. Jesus is put on trial and the Sanhedrin is looking for evidence to put him to death. They've either found or organized these false witnesses. And now that they have the defendant, they can start their trial. But things don't go according to plan. Each witness gives conflicting evidence. Clearly, they didn't talk to each other beforehand. And it becomes very clear quickly that the trial is a complete farce. They cannot get the witnesses' stories to agree. And so in a last-ditch attempt to get something useful, the high priest stands up and tries to get Jesus to incriminate himself. Have a look at verse 60. Then the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, "Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you?" But Jesus remained silent and gave no answer. Again the high priest asked him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" Just like the suffering servant, Jesus remains silent. The high priest then clearly states who Jesus is. It is one of the most clearly stated, most clear statements about who Jesus is in Mark's gospel. And it's who the religious authorities thought Jesus was. "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" The high priest is exactly right. He, along with the centurion at the cross, give the most complete confession of who Jesus is, and yet these are those responsible for his death. Jesus replies and clearly proclaims who he is. He says, "I am, and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." So why does Jesus now openly acknowledge who he is? All through Mark's gospel, he's been careful that whenever someone has said, "You're the Son of God," he silenced them. He didn't allow people to acknowledge him as the Son of God. What has changed that he acknowledges it now? Maybe it's because the religious leaders had made their intentions so clear. His suffering and death were locked in, so to speak, and he could be open for the first time about who he was. It didn't matter anymore what people thought of him. It wasn't going to affect the fact that God's will would be done. In the face of persecution, when his fight or flight response could have kicked in, Jesus remained faithful and truthful to God's plan. Well, this is all the evidence that the high priest thinks he needs. It's ironic, isn't it, that the false evidence that they have sought was of no use to them at all. However, they twist the one bit of truthful evidence to wrongfully convict Jesus to death, the fact that he is the Son of God, and then his suffering begins. The high priest tore his clothes. He said, "Why do we need any more witnesses?" he asked. "You have heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" They all condemned him as worthy of death, and then they began to spit on him. They blindfolded him, struck him with their fists, and said, "Prophesy." And the guards took him and beat him. Again, Mark's account is full of irony. It is the Sanhedrin that is blaspheming, when it does not recognize that Jesus really is the Son of God. And they mock Jesus' ability to prophesy. And yet it is all of Jesus' prophecies that come true. It is Jesus who is the true witness and faithful, and the religious leaders who are false and faithless. And all this time while Jesus is in this upper room undergoing this trial, Peter is down in the courtyard undergoing a different kind of trial. And Mark returns to him in verses 67 to 72. Peter had gathered around a fire to keep warm, and yet the light that goes with the warmth had given him away, Have a look at verse 66. While Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came by. When she saw Peter warming himself, she looked closely at him. "You were with that Nazarene, Jesus," she said. But he denied it. "I don't know or understand what you're talking about," he said. And he went out into the entryway. Peter denies total knowledge of Jesus. "I don't know or understand what you're talking about," he said. He denies both knowing who Jesus is or ever having heard of him. He must have been nervous, though, and because he moves closer to the door, closer to the entryway. But this change of place is no substitute for a change of heart. And the servant girl sees him again and accuses him again in verse 69. "This fellow is one of them." And again he denied it. This time he seemed to lose the plot. And he goes into an extended denial. But this just seems to give the people around him more ammunition. It gives him away. Have a look at the second part of verse 70. "Surely you are one of them, for you are a Galilean." In Peter denying it, he gave himself away with his accent. They recognized where he came from, that he was from Galilee, that he had been with Jesus. The last accusation is the boldest, and Peter's denial is the strongest. He swears that he doesn't know this man, that he's too ashamed to name. And he calls down curses on himself and swears to them, "I do not know this man you're talking about." As one commentator says, Peter had hoped to escape notice, and yet he ends up betraying Jesus by what he says, where he stands, and how he says it. No amount of swearing or protesting can stop the rooster crowing, and so Peter realizes what he's done. In contrast to Jesus, who was faithful and true in the face of a false trial and persecution, Peter was faithless and false in the face of truthful questions from a servant girl. Peter denied Jesus without even using his name. Just ordinary words and actions were enough. In Mark's account of the arrest and trial of Jesus, we see that Jesus was faithful and true. And in contrast, the disciples and religious leaders are seen as faithless and false. Mark gives two examples of being faithless and false: the betrayer Judas and the denier Peter. Did Judas really sell out Jesus for money? Did he really love money more than Jesus? We too betray Jesus when we put our financial goals before Jesus. We too betray Jesus when we call something else our first love. Did Judas betray Jesus for power? Was it that he got frustrated by the way that Jesus talked about being meek and loving? Did Judas think that he was too low down the pecking order of the disciples? We too betray Jesus when we prefer our goals to his, our aims, our ways to his. It is a betrayal to ask Jesus to put himself at our disposal rather than to put ourselves at his disposal. Did Judas really think that the crowd would need clubs and swords to arrest Jesus? We too betray Jesus when we give signs of close friendship and being involved with him, and yet we don't really know him. We too can so easily betray Jesus in what we do and say. Did Peter deny Jesus because he was in physical danger? Did Peter deny Jesus because a servant girl was going to find out that he knew Jesus? We too deny Jesus when we seek to hide the fact that we know Jesus. We deny Jesus just like Peter without even using his name. We deny him with just ordinary words and actions. If you were on your way to a lunchtime Bible study at work and someone asked you where you were going, would you own up to knowing Jesus, or would you just say, "I'm off to a meeting"? Have you ever felt the temptation on a Monday morning when someone said, "What did you do on the weekend?" not to own up to knowing Jesus, to saying nothing about going to church? But to those who are naked, guilty, and ashamed, like the betrayer, like the denier, to those who have betrayed Jesus for money, power, or status, to those who have denied Jesus out of fear, whether big or small, to those who are faithless and false, the faithful Jesus holds out a robe of righteousness. As we will see, he will go to the cross so that we can be clothed. The betrayal sent Jesus to the cross, and yet the cross is what gives the faithless, the betrayer, the denier, a chance at forgiveness. The cross is what gives us a chance at forgiveness, to forgive our betrayal and our denial. And all of this because Jesus is faithful and true, and did the will of the Father.